Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities with Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. School districts across New York State have been implementing cell phone bans as the first day of classes got underway this week. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse Taylor with more.
Shenandoah students filed into the high school this morning for the first day of classes. But this year's first day marked a new routine as students in New York must forego cell phones to comply with a new statewide mandate. The mandate, included in this year's state budget, requires school districts to implement a bell-to-bell ban on internet-enabled devices like cell phones, laptops, and tablets for the entire school day. However, the state policy gives districts some leeway on how they decide to implement the mandate. Some districts will ask their students to simply keep cell phones out of sight and away by any means, while others, like Shenandoah Central School District in Clifton Park, are requiring that students store devices in designated containers.
We are excited to have our students back on campus and to hear the buzz of learning that happens when they join us. So it's feeling pretty good this morning.
Cecily Wilson-Turner, the school district's interim superintendent, said she hopes the cell phone policy will not be too big of a change.
We have worked for a long time to ensure our students' engagement and to ensure that they have the least amount of distractions possible when they're in the classrooms. And so very explicitly, our middle schools last year made a really concerted effort to help our middle school students understand the importance of their cell phones being secured in their lockers at all times so that they were not in classrooms. At the high school, the same expectation was that you do not have your cell phone out in class unless it was used for an instructional purpose.
She says while the middle and high schools have slightly different practices, the importance of keeping devices away during instructional time was emphasized across the district last year. Shenandoah Middle School students must keep their devices in lockers throughout the day, while high school students will be required to put their cell phones in storage containers scattered throughout their teachers' classrooms. Governor Kathy Hochul first floated the state policy during this year's State of the State address in January.
But to truly free our kids from social media, we must give them safe places to simply be kids. It's just common sense. That's why I'm launching the Unplug and Play initiative.
Eventually, the proposal made its way into the final state budget passed by the legislature in April, becoming law. In August, districts had to have a published policy on their respective websites. While the vast majority of schools across the state are complying with the mandate, the policy has been met with both a positive and negative reception. Critics like David Albert, the chief communications and marketing officer from the New York State School Boards Association, say the policy is an overreach.
We felt that school boards are elected by their communities, that they should be empowered to create a policy that makes sense in their community. So there's other options besides just bell-to-bell. Bell-to-bell is draconian.
While supporters of the policy, like Natalie McKay, a member of the New York State United Teachers Board of Directors, say the policy will improve students' social skills. McKay is also a middle school English teacher at Schoharie Central School District, which was one of the first districts in the state to adopt a bell-to-bell ban on cell phones. Schoharie's policy has been in place for a few years.
You'll walk through our cafeteria, and you won't see any students on cell phones. They're talking to one another. They're engaging with one another. I was walking through a couple months ago, and students were playing cards. I mean, it's a completely different way of life. It goes back to when I started teaching in the early 2000s.
Time will tell how parents, students, and school faculty will adapt to the new change. I'm Jesse Taylor.
As colleges and universities begin a new school year, many are grappling with how to implement and regulate the use of artificial intelligence. The Legislative Gazette's Aaron Shella Levine reports on one campus's considerations.
I'm going to go to these learning objectives, and this is like the most boring slide in the whole thing, but I feel like...
Sam Hawk is just days away from teaching his first statistic classes at Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs. In fact, it'll be his first time teaching anywhere as a full-fledged professor.
Sort of what I'm thinking about doing is designing a policy with my students where on the first day of class, I will give each of them a pad of Post-it notes. And display, I think what I'll do is display a question just on a slide that says, is artificial intelligence appropriate to use in this class? And then I'll give them 8 minutes, and in those 8 minutes, I will expect them to write like 15 questions.
With the explosive growth in use of AI models like ChatGPT, Hawk has been busy preparing a collaborative approach.
And so by the end of that class, the goal would be to have an idea of what questions we should answer in determining what that policy should be. And then by the second class, hopefully we will all have thought about it and we can think about it more, but the goal would be to try to answer some of those questions. And I think hopefully that would be helpful in determining what the AI policy should be.
He says because AI is so prevalent, he believes it's important to work with students to determine what role the technology should play in his classrooms.
So I don't have a policy yet. I sort of lean more towards, yeah, the students will have access to this tool, so they should gain familiarity with it. But I definitely don't want that to replace learning. You know, I don't want it to just be like, I give the students the work, they type it into the AI, they hand it back to me, and then I type their work into the AI and say, grade this for me, because then what's happening?
American Studies professor Beck Crafting is the director of Skidmore's Center for Leadership, Teaching, and Learning and runs a new faculty orientation program. She says Hawk's approach is encouraging.
Having those clear boundaries and setting a shared understanding of how to use AI is going to actually help to prevent the misuse of AI throughout the rest of the semester by the students. And they're hungry for clarity and transparency around how they're going to use it. They don't want to misuse it. Most of them are not trying to use them for nefarious ends, but they, without any instruction or guidance, could easily do so without meaning to do so.
Crafting emphasizes that there is no one-size-fits-all solution to AI in the classroom. Skidmore faculty and staff are working to adopt the new technology for various learning environments.
Well, it's really important that we don't infringe on academic freedom. And so even as I create space for training and increased literacy, I want to be clear that it is not something that we are trying to impose upon faculty or staff. It's kind of like, this is here and it's happening. We want you to understand it. And then we want you to make informed decisions about how you use it or if you use it at all or the degree to which you use it.
There are, however, some professors who are not as accepting of artificial intelligence.
I do think, you know, we all teach at Skidmore College undergraduates. And those are students of a certain age. So I believe AI can play a role for graduate students, for professional scholars, but there's a developmental or staging argument that makes me think that AI should play no role in the classroom.
English professor Barbara Black is restructuring her classes this year. No grading rubrics, since students can plug them into large language models like ChatGPT, more oral exams, and an emphasis on in-class participation.
I'm making sure, particularly in my composition class, that we read about AI and its relationship to writing. I want my students not to be AI fluent, but AI literate. And what I mean by that distinction is I want them to understand that ChatGPT can take away their agency, it can take away their voice, it can rob them of the opportunity to develop something that I don't think we talk a lot about, rob them of the opportunity of taste, developing a sense of their taste. Who are the more important scholars? Who are the scholars who speak to them? Who are the authors who speak to them?
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Aaron Shallow Levine.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with Max Kenner, founder and executive director of the Barred Prison Initiative, which seeks to educate the incarcerated in order to return them to the world with a better life. I asked Max about a restorative or rehabilitative model versus a retributive or punishment model.
We think that our prison systems, like all of our government institutions, should represent the best of our values. And of course, when we lock people away, provide them with no opportunity, typically they come back to their communities less prepared to make meaningful contributions and more likely to either commit more crime or to generally simply be dependent on their families or the government for support to survive. Those are things that we want to avoid. And frankly, for decades, there was a bipartisan consensus that we wanted to move in that direction to reduce prison recidivism and reduce the number of Americans in prison, period. But I also, David, want to suggest that there's a whole nother way of looking at this issue from the perspective of a college or a university. And that has nothing to do necessarily with American criminal justice and is simply focused on the reality that we have too few Americans engaged or enrolled in ambitious, serious higher education in the United States. It costs too much. The bureaucracy is too thick. And we, as leaders in higher education, must do more to be imaginative in going to where potential students are or might be and helping them become ambitious, creative, civic, intellectual business thinkers moving into the future. It's an incredible tragedy, but for decades in the United States, if we were looking for precisely that kind of talent across the country, our state prison systems would be one of the first places anyone should go looking for underengaged talent in the United States.
Yeah. Now, let's expand on this a little bit and tell us more about Bard's Prison Initiative. You mentioned in your remarks this is not a sideshow, and I'm sure that you get accused of, you know, this can't be a real program. How can it be the same standards at Bard College? You must be pushing these people through to show success rates. Explain what makes this a quality program and why it's not so easy for folks to get in, and the reason why you can claim success later on.
It's not so easy to get in because demand within the prison is overwhelming. But once a student is admitted to the college, they enroll in an academic program that is identical in intensity, in breadth, and in academic expectation as what happens on Bard's main campus, where students come from high schools and often elite high schools from all over the country and, in fact, all over the world. So students who may not have been in a formal classroom for years or often decades, but who feel a burning desire, a burning personal need to do more intellectually, to do more with their personal ambition, dive into this sort of college experience and do extraordinarily well. Attrition from the college is very, very low. The breadth of what students study is equal to what happens on campus. In fact, at the bachelor's degree level, at BPI, we offer associate's, bachelor's, and master's degrees, which we can talk about. But for students who choose a major and finish a bachelor's degree, the percentage of students in the prisons who complete degrees in STEM fields, in math or science, is greater than the percentage on Bard's main campus. And students who complete bachelor's degrees in the humanities or the social sciences write what we call at Bard a senior project, which is an original research paper, typically of 80 or 100 pages in length. And Bard students who are released from prison and go on to continue academic study after release have completed graduate degrees and PhDs at universities like Columbia, Cornell, Georgetown, Yale, you name it. So these students, despite all prejudice, accomplish all the kinds of things that undergraduates do anywhere else.
Max Kenner, these programs, I'm guessing, many in the state don't even know they exist, including those who have relatives or friends or others who are incarcerated. Where are all of these schools? How do you reach the prisoners? How does it work?
So at BPI, which is now one of a number of college and prison opportunities in New York. Decades ago, we were one of just a much smaller number, but we've been able to restore this field thanks to the leadership of New Yorkers. This field is being restored nationally, but it's important to say that everything we do, and this work is done best, not remotely, not via the mail, not via the internet or the tablet, but in person, in the same way higher education has been done for decades or, in fact, centuries. Interested people reading the same text, sitting around a table or a classroom and debating those ideas. So every day across 7 prisons in New York, 450 incarcerated New Yorkers engage with college faculty and with each other in a course of study, again, that spans the full breadth of the liberal arts, math, science, history, anthropology, literature, studio arts, you name it. Students go on to complete an associate degree, then if they have time, a bachelor's degree. And just last year at Eastern Correctional Facility in the Catskills, we created our first master's degree for incarcerated New Yorkers.
That's Max Kenner, founder and executive director of the Barred Prison Initiative. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The donation of a cadaver, like those made through Albany Medical College's anatomical gift program, offers early doctors a personal and emotional connection to their profession while offering donor families solace from their loved one's gift. The Legislative Gazette's Samantha Simmons was there as dozens of families gathered to celebrate those who donated their bodies for research.
Victoria Turkington, a student at Albany Medical College, says that working with a cadaver offered she and her classmates the chance to sit with the humanity of their studies.
It's an emotional experience because caring for people is supposed to be. There's a reason that we say that our donor is our first patient. During lab, you start to see how balancing technical understanding and learning with connection and humanity will be a lifelong walk on a tightrope. No matter the technical task ahead, you will always have to advocate for and appreciate the tremendous gift of trust that your patients share with you. You and your loved ones trusted us unconditionally to honor them, and that is not something that any of us take lightly.
Turkington, a member of the class of 2028, says the opportunity to learn from the donated cadavers prepares medical students to hold, mindfully, the hands of the patients they will care for in the future. To honor the 171 people who donated their bodies to Albany Medical College's anatomical gift program, a recent ceremony was held at the Albany Rural Cemetery to unite the families of the deceased with those who are now learning from them. 59-year-old Duana Mullis succumbed to idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis in April 2024. Mullis's niece, Kayla Landon, says Mullis left her family with a sense of satisfaction for the gift she left behind.
I had faith in that, you know, everyone would be respectful and that the, you know, this is something for to better people and for people to learn from. So I was more proud of her than anything.
Her aunt's decision to donate her body was a reflection of the type of person she was, Landon said. Landon and her aunts, one of whom is Mullis's twin, wore pink shirts to honor Mullis.
She was a light. You can see from the shirts, her smile lit up the room. She was always laughing, always smiling. Yes, yes, she had a great laugh. She loved helping other people. You know, even just walking by someone, she had to always give a compliment. She has a twin sister as well, who is very similar. And we miss her dearly. She was definitely an integral part of our family.
Mullis, who was diagnosed in December and died 5 months later, was in hospice when she made the decision to donate her body for educational purposes. During the event, family members and medical students placed flowers on a casket intended to represent the 171 people who supported the college's research and education agenda. After medical student Beatrice Barbacino's grandmother died from Alzheimer's disease, she was consoled by a poem by Mary Elizabeth Fry. She read from it at the cemetery.
Do not stand at my grave and weep. I am not there. I do not sleep. I'm a thousand winds that blow. I'm the diamond glints on snow. I am the sunlight on ripened grain. I'm the gentle autumn rain. When you awaken in the morning's hush, I'm the swift uplifting rush of quiet birds in circled flight. I'm the soft stars that shine at night. Do not stand at my grave and cry. I am not there. I did not die.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Samantha Simmons.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Well, as summer winds down and autumn begins, people across New York and the Northeast are wondering what this year's fall foliage season will be like. Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley finds out what people who study trees and foliage anticipate.
Color changes can typically be spotted in the highest elevations of the Adirondacks and Green Mountains beginning in mid to late August. There are already small patches of color, and some trees are already dropping brown leaves. Dr. Mark Lesser, SUNY Plattsburgh Center for Earth and Environmental Science, associate professor and forest ecologist, says there are a number of factors that impact the timing and vibrancy of fall leaves.
It's driven by a lot of things, primarily by changes in day length, so shortening days, and then really having cool evenings and nights. But on top of that, the prolonged drought this summer is potentially stressing a lot of the trees, which means that the trees might just drop their leaves that are already brown instead of us seeing those color changes.
Northeast Regional Climate Center Director Dr. Art DiGaetano says drought conditions across the region will be a factor in the annual autumnal color change.
The main areas that we're seeing drought in right now are actually northern New York into Vermont, into New Hampshire, and then northern New England. Other areas of the region that have been fairly droughty are like coastal Maine and parts of western New York. You know, the areas that you typically think of in terms of the best foliage, they have seen a fair amount of drought.
Paul Smith's College Professor Emeritus of Forestry, Randall Swanson, says what colors emerge will depend on the severity of drought.
Up here in Saranac Lake, Lake Placid area, the drought hasn't been real bad, so we're looking at a likelihood of a really nice display. The actual changing of the leaves, what's really helpful is to have sunny days and cool nights that will trap some of the sugars that are used for producing some of the reds and purples. The yellows and oranges, they're already there. They're just being, you know, masked by the chlorophyll. And as the tree shuts down, which is part of its normal process, that chlorophyll disappears and it reveals those underlying yellows and orange colors.
Dr. Lesser doesn't expect an earlier season, but predicts less vibrancy.
Because a lot of the leaves are already stressed out and wilting and browning due to the drought conditions that we've had over the summer. But I think, you know, we should still have some good colors. All of the trees are not stressed, and it's a species-specific thing. And so there still will be some color, but I think it might be, because of the drought this year, more muted than it has been in many years.
Vermont Department of Forest, Parks and Recreation Forest Health Program Manager Josh Hallman says the upcoming foliage season could be incredibly vibrant, depending on the location.
There's some areas where trees are growing in soils that are really rich and healthy, and although there might be some drought stress around, their general health looks really good. And so those areas could be very vibrant. We'll see what the weather brings between now and the end of September. But there's still plenty of hope for a vibrant fall foliage season.
Lake Placid-based Regional Office of Sustainable Tourism Chief Operating Officer Mary Jane Lawrence says fall foliage is a large part of the region's tourism economy. Roost tracks visitors to the region, and there has been a drop in Canadian visitors this year.
Overall, they're about 5% of our total market. New York, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, and Connecticut are our strongest fall markets.
Swanson believes the vibrancy of fall leaves is often in the eye of the beholder.
If it's kind of cloudy and, you know, it's overcast, it just doesn't have the same vibrancy as if you're out there viewing on a day when the sun is hitting those leaves just in the right way and they almost look like they're glowing.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
That about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2536. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Giustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.